te vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 54, Chapter entitled The Marriage of Krishna and Rukmini. Text number 9 onwards. Hanyamana,
Hanyamana,
Balanika,
Balanika,
Vrishnibir,
Vrishnibir,
Jaya,
Jaya,
Kangshibi,
Kangshibi,
Rajano,
Rajano,
Vimukha,
Vimukha,
Jagmur,
Jagmur,
Jarasandha,
Jarasandha,
Pura,
Pura,
Sara,
Sara,
Hanyamana Balanika,
Hanyamana Balanika,
Vrishnibir Jaya Kangshibi,
Vrishnibir Jaya Kangshibi,
Rajano Vimukha Jagmur,
Rajano Vimukha Jagmur,
Jarasandha Purasara,
Jarasandha Purasara,
Hanyamana Balanika,
Hanyamana Balanika,
Vrishnibir Jaya Kangshibi,
Vrishnibir Jaya Kangshibi,
Rajano Vimukha Jagmur,
Rajano Vimukha Jagmur,
Jarasandha Purasara,
Jarasandha Purasara,
Hanyamana Balanika,
Hanyamana Balanika,
Vrishnibir Jaya Kangshibi,
Vrishnibir Jaya Kangshibi,
Rajano Vimukha Jagmur,
Rajano Vimukha Jagmur,
Jarasandha Purasara,
Jarasandha Purasara.
Hanyamana,
Hanyamana,
being killed.
Balanika,
Balanika, whose armies?
Vrishnibi,
Vrishnibi,
by the Vrishnis.
Jaya,
Jaya,
for victory.
For victory.
Kangshibi,
Kangshibi,
who were eager.
Who were eager.
Rajana,
Rajana,
the kings. Vimukha,
Vimukha,
discouraged.
Discouraged.
Jagmu,
Jagmu,
left.
Yeah.
Jarasandha Purasara,
Jarasandha Purasara,
headed by Jarasandha.
Jarasandha.
Translation of PowerPoints by the following is Srila Prabhupada. Seeing their armies being struck down by the Vrishnis, who were eager for victory, the kings headed by Jarasandha were discouraged and left the battlefield. Translation responsibly. Seeing their armies being struck down by the Vrishnis, who were eager for victory, the kings headed by Jarasandha
were
discouraged
and left the battlefield.
Purport. Although Shishupal had not married Rukmini, he passionately considered her his property, and thus he was devastated, like a man who has lost his beloved wife. Text 10. The kings approached Shishupal, who was disturbed like a man who had lost his wife. His complexion was drained of colour, his enthusiasm was gone, and his face appeared dried up. The kings spoke to him as follows. Jarasandha said, "Listen, Shishupal, O tiger among men, give up your depression. After all, embodied beings' happiness and unhappiness is never seen to be permanent, O King. Just as a puppet in the form of a woman dances by the desire of the puppeteer, so this world, controlled by the Supreme Lord, struggles in both happiness and misery. By the will of the Supreme Lord, living beings are awarded the proper results of their own activities. One who understands the absolute truth surrenders to the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and is no longer considered to be within the material system of existence. Since those endeavouring within the material system or world are necessarily trying to exploit the creation of God, they must be subjected to reactions, which are perceived by the conditioned souls as miserable and joyful. In fact, the entire material way of life is a fiasco when seen from the perspective of absolute bliss. Omagyan timanandasya ginamjina shalakaya chakshun nilitam yena tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swa Padantikam Vamsha Kalpata Rubyascha Kripa Sindubi Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishna Bebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama,
Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So Jarasandha is preaching to Shishupal, like that. So normally, the demoniac persons, we don't normally listen to them because their advice will not be proper or will not be correct and will not give us the proper direction. So normally if Jarasandha would speak, we would not pay much attention because in the past he was not, he did not show that he had the right attitude towards Krishna. And one who does not have the right attitude towards Krishna is demoniac in consciousness. In the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna divides the entire material world into two types of personalities. What does he call them?
Divine
and demoniac. Sura and Asura. Like that. So Krishna says everyone in the material world is within these two categories. You're either Sura or Asura. Sura means you are theistic. It means you accept God. Asura means you are demoniac, you do not accept God's supremacy. Like that. Some people, they just do not accept there is a God. Atheistic. Right? So envious of God, the conditioned soul has become, they'll even deny that he even exists. Just like if you really can't stand someone, then you may ignore them. Right? Because you just cannot stand them. So better just to imagine they're not there. Right? Just total indifference like that. You know, I can't even be bothered, you know, understanding that you exist like that. You mean nothing to me like that. So the conditioned souls become so envious of Krishna when they leave the spiritual world and come to the material world. They become so envious of him that they even get to the point where they deny his existence, that he doesn't even exist at all. And this is an interesting phenomenon because, as Prabhupada describes, originally everyone is Krishna conscious. Right? Originally everyone is a pure devotee. Originally we were all in the Vaikuntha Dham in Goloka Vrindavan. And we were pure devotees of Krishna. 100% giving our love to Krishna. 100% surrendered to Krishna. Right? Full of prema bhakti. And then the conditioned soul comes in the material world and sometimes they become so bewildered by the material energy, they even deny that that person who previously they had fully given their heart to and who they were created to serve unconditionally, with unconditional love, with prema, that person they deny that he even exists. So that's how powerful the material energy is. And that's how powerful the envious nature of the conditioned soul can become. That once you come in contact with the material energy, then you can become so bewildered that you even deny that God even exists. Like that. So this is the cause of our coming to the material world. Sometimes people ask, why did we come to this material world? Why? How did we get here in the first place? Like that. And you'll see in practically every single philosophy and theosophy, theological thought, every philosophical thought for thousands of years in every culture of the world, none of them can answer the question. Why is it that, why are we here? You know, how do we end up? If we are spiritual by nature, if we are the soul, how do we arrive in this circumstance? How do we get ourselves into such a mess? So the only answer which is given is through the Vaishnava Siddhanta, which is actually the Vedic Siddhanta. The Vedas actually teach that the soul became envious of God. Prabhupada says he misused his independence. And through that misuse of independence, that's how we left Krishna. Right? Otherwise, what is the explanation? Right? Otherwise, like these days, if you go to, because in the Western world, most commonly we deal with some form of what they call Christian doctrine. You know, we deal with people that say, I am Christian. Or, you know, we follow some Western Judaic Christian kind of philosophy or tradition. And they've got no idea how we got here. Right? Or if they give an idea, it's totally speculative and it's totally wrong. Right? And they've got no idea what we're doing here, and they've got no idea where we're going to go after this. Right? You just die, and if you're a good person, you just go back to heaven. So then the question, the first question that arises in a philosophical mind, why did we leave heaven? Where were we before this life? Right? And then they'll give all sorts of speculations. Sometimes they'll say, well, we didn't even exist. Yeah, we just got created, right? And after we were created, then it all began. Right? That, there's no logic in that whatsoever. No logic in that whatsoever. It doesn't even make sense. At least, and this is the problem, because Prabhupada says that religion and philosophy must run parallel. Right? Philosophy without religion becomes fanaticism. Right? And religion without philosophy becomes sentimentality. Right? And that's what you see these days. You speak to people who call themselves religious, but it's just sentimentalism. Right? There's no logic in what they're saying. You can't have a philosophical conversation with someone who's not logical. Like that. And similarly, if there's no religion in philosophy, then it's just speculative. You know, someone will give their ideas and their interpretations of the absolute truth, but if there's no God in the philosophy, then it's just a speculation. Just like in Kali Yuga, because we're in Kali Yuga now, so in Kali Yuga you see all sorts of crazy things manifest each day. And apparently I heard that in America, every single day in America, there's 5 new religions that are invented. And just to take one as an example, like that, take the Church of Scientology. Right? Take that as an example, Kali Yuga religion. There's no God in the religion. There's no God in the philosophy. Now, if you look at the original Latin of the original word religion, religio. Right? What does re mean? Re means to do again. Reunite. Ligio means to link. Relink with God. That's what religion means. Relink with God. And now we have religions where there's no God to relink with. And they call that religion. And they it registers themselves as a religion. Right? And some guy who used to be a science fiction writer, he's now the founder of Acharya of the religion. This is Kali Yuga. This is the age of Kali. You know, we see every crazy thing. It was funny because in America recently, well, it was a few years back, I can't remember, 5 years ago or something, they were doing a census, like a poll or survey, and they were sending it around everyone. And you had to write, you know, what is your age, what is your sex, what is your, you know, marital status, what is this, what is that, what is your religion? So then they got, because then it said, you know, Mormon, Christian, Jew, Hindu, Muslim, Scientologist, other, like that. So then the one that they didn't consider was Jedi. Right? And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people wrote on the census, Jedi. What is your religion? Jedi. Right? Right? Where does the Jedi religion come from? Right? It comes from George Lucas. right? It comes from someone who wrote a movie in 1977 or produced the movie in 1977. And now, you know, we have a religion which has come out of that, which is actually, it's better than Scientology. Yeah, at least there's a force. Yeah. At least there's something. What's that? Yeah, I mean, I'm into the religion, as many people are. That's why they're writing it down. And it's actually good. It's many things. It's actually interesting. One of the later episodes, when Yoda is preaching, I think to Anakin, I think it is. I can't remember who he's preaching to. But when Yoda is preaching, he's actually speaking Bhagavad Gita 263. It's pretty much verbatim. It's Bhagavad Gita. Yes, Mataji.
I just said, on the street, when I'm showing the picture, I quote Yoda in Star Wars, and I say, Yoda says to Luke Skywalker, and I think the second episode, he says, the force is within us, it's within all living entities, it finds us in it, it finds the galaxy together, and it's sort of that super soldier community, living entity.
Yeah, it's a powerful preaching tool. We can use modern thought in order to bring people towards Krishna consciousness like that. So the point is that this is how much the conditioned souls become bewildered when they come to the material world. Right? They'll do anything and everything in order to defy God's supremacy. And therefore, the Vedas have three divisions or three schools of thought, right? Jnana, karma, and bhakti. These are the three items of knowledge. I mean, there's also sambandha, abhideya, progen, there's different divisions, but one of the divisions is karma, jnana, and bhakti. So, through karma, right, which means sense gratification, right, then the conditioned soul will try to deny God's existence in every way possible, right? Because if there's a God, that immediately wrecks your sense gratification. Right? Because most of what you're doing, you're not supposed to be doing according to God. Right? So that just wrecked all of that. Right? So then, you know, we can't have a good time anymore. So then what do you do? Well, it doesn't exist. And now I can do whatever I want with a free consciousness. Right? And then I'll suffer like hell in the next lifetime. Right? And then, jnana, right, through jnana, then we'll also deny God's existence. And people will come up with all sorts of philosophies, especially now in Kali Yuga. You know, all sorts of New Age philosophies and, you know, just unlimited trains of thought to deny that God exists like that. Just like if you read any of the, you know, New Age kind of magazines, just like Living Now and all these different ones, then if you read if you open the first page and you see the letter from the editor, then she always finishes her letter. She always writes with love and light. Mm. Right? With light. You know, just light. You know, with love and light. Right? Like that. So deny that God exists. Right? Not that he's a person. Right? Why not write, you know, I hope you are happy in Krishna consciousness. Right? Except that there is a supreme personality. So the conditioned soul will do anything in this material world to deny that God exists. Right? And this is the problem. And even here we see we have a demoniac personality preaching. You have Jarasandha, who normally we would not listen to, because he does not accept that Krishna is supreme. When, if you read in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, like we're reading now, it's one of the further chapters, a little bit further down. Then Bhima, when it's time to get rid of Jarasandha, when Krishna wants to get rid of Jarasandha, then he takes Bhima and Arjuna, and they dress up as brahmanas, and they go to visit Jarasandha. And when Jarasandha sees them, Jarasandha's, I would imagine he's about 12 foot tall. Right? He's like a huge warrior. Like he's... You know, he's a powerful personality. And Bhima was also 12 foot tall. Bhima was like, but he's dressed as a Brahmana. You know, put a chatter around him. And, you know, walked in as if he's a Brahmana, you know. And Krishna and Arjuna, who were also, Krishna was 7 foot tall. And Arjuna was around that height as well. And they were like warriors, the most powerful warriors. Then they all walked in dressed as Brahmanas. And Jarasandha looked at them. And he saw on their shoulder was a groove in their shoulder from where they were carrying their bows, because the Kshatriyas carry the bows in the shoulder, and they develop a groove from the bow string, like that. So he walked in, and they all walked in, he looked and he saw the, like that, and he said, "I do not think you are Brahmins." And they all looked at him and they said, "Actually, you're correct. We're not Brahmins," like that. And he said, "But because you have come dressed as Brahmins, then I will treat you as Brahmins. And whatever you ask from me as a Kshatriya, I will give you in charity. You can ask me anything you want." So then they said to Jarasandha, "Then we beg one thing. We beg a battle. We beg a fight. We want you to step outside onto the battlefield and do us a favor. Like, come out and give us a duel, give us a battle." So Jarasandha looked at Arjuna and Krishna and he said, "You two have not got a hope. You two would not even be worth me fighting. You're weak. So this is atheism. Imagine going to Radha Vallabha in the morning when the curtains open and saying, "You are weak." You can't even imagine. This is the supreme personality. But because of atheism, he says to Krishna, "You are weak." Imagine saying, "You are weak." "Yeah, sure, Jarasandha." Right, gone. Just doesn't exist anymore. Right, now it comes back. Right, here's Sudarshan Chakra. Speak to him. Right? No hope. Like that. So this is atheism, like that. So then Jarasandha said, "But I will fight this one, Bhimasena. He is equal." Right? So they went outside and they got their clubs and they beat each other, right? All day long, from morning till night, just beat each other with the clubs, right? And then at the end of the day, at the end of the night, then when the sun went down, then Jarasandha said, "Please come into my palace, right? You are my honorable guest. Please come to my palace and dine with me." So they would go into the palace, and this is the Vedic system, that even when the enemy comes to your home, then you should treat them like as good as God, right? With all respect. So he asked them to come in, and then they sat around the table and they were having dinner. And Jarasandha and Bhima were speaking to each other, and they said, "That was very good today, that battle. You're a very expert club fighter." And Jarasandha would say, "Yes, you're also very expert. Where did you learn all this?" Like that. And then they would discuss like that. "And you hit me in the arm today. Your club is as strong as the thunderbolt of Indra." Like that. And they glorify each other as Kshatriyas. It's like sport. They love it. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, "Happier Kshatriyas for which a fighting opportunity comes unsought." Like that. They become enthused. Battle. "You want to fight? Okay, let's go outside." It's sport for them. It's fun. Yeah? If I die, I die. I'll go to heaven. I'll go to Swarga. That's what Krishna guarantees in the Bhagavad Gita. If you die, you'll go to the heavenly plane. So what's the problem? Let's fight. Let's be happy. Right? I haven't got a problem. If you want to fight, then let's just fight. And then whoever dies, dies, and so be it. And if you win, then you get the kingdom. And if you die, you go to the heavenly kingdom. So what's the problem? That's the Kshatriya spirit. So Jarasandha, normally there's nothing to hear from him because his consciousness is totally wrong like that. But in this particular circumstance, he's actually speaking Vedic wisdom. He's actually speaking according to the absolute truth, because he has some experience. And when the conditioned soul rebels against God, the way that God deals with the conditioned soul is to reawaken his consciousness so that he will come back home, back to Godhead. Prabhupada said there are two reasons why the material world was created. The first reason why the material world is created is to satisfy the desires of the living entities to enjoy separate from him. But then Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, however, there is a there is some fine print, or there is the unwritten clause, which is there, which I forgot to tell you about, like that. Just like you buy something and they forget to tell you, "Oh yeah, by the way," like that. So there's something that Krishna says, "Okay, I give you a material world, right? I don't just give you like an island or a country or a state. I give you a universe if you want to enjoy separately from me. But there's something that you must know. Dukala yama shashwatam. Right? You will suffer like hell. And everything you have is temporary. everything that you experience will only give you temporary satisfaction. Right? Your marriage will end. Right? Your life, your body will end. Your wealth will be taken away from you. Your beauty will disappear. What else is there?
Fame.
Your fame will be stolen.
Strength. Like that.
Strength. Your strength will be taken. You'll become a weak, invalid old man. Just like you see Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What was his mantra?
I am the greatest.
I am the greatest. Right? How bewildered do you have to be? I am the greatest. I fight like a butterfly. I sting like a bee. Very fearful opponent. Right? You would not want to get into the ring with him. Very fearful opponent. But now he's got... Which one's he got?
Parkinson's.
So now he's like... That's Muhammad Ali. Right? I am the greatest. Right? I am the greatest. Yeah. Nothing left anymore. Everything taken by the material energy. So that is the reality of the material world. So Krishna creates it for two reasons. One is to satisfy your material desires, which is not going to happen. And two is that when you get it out of your system, right, then you can start going back to Godhead. Right? They're the two reasons why he creates the material world. So we see that the conditioned souls, when they try to enjoy separately from Krishna, then what does Krishna do? Right? Krishna will reciprocate with the conditioned souls in such a way that they will get a realization that this is not my eternal home. Right? We have so many problems in our lives. Right? Just like if you had to write a list of all the problems you have at the moment, right? Physical, mental, financial, you know, environmental. You know, if you had to write all the problems you had in your life, right? You write a significant list. Right? It's significant, you know, all the problems we have in our life. And all of those problems can be solved within one moment. Right? Krishna says, Bhakti-amam abhijanati yavanyash chasmi tatvataha. You just have to accept me as being the supreme absolute truth. Right? Krishna says, 1866? Savadaman purujyajya. Mam ekam. Sharanam Braja. Aham Twam Sava Papebyo. Moksha Nishami Masuchaha. Moksha means liberation. Right? I'll take you to a place where not only is it called Vaikuntha, not only is there no suffering, but there is unlimited bliss. Right? I'll take you to that place. In a moment, if you surrender to me. Right? In one moment, if we just become Krishna conscious. In one moment, we'll be in Goloka Vrindavan with Krishna. Okay. So that is what Krishna desires. So therefore, he treats the conditioned souls in such a way in order to bring them to that point. That's what the material world is for. So in that way, the material world is our mother. And Durga Devi is considered to be our mother, and Lord Shiva is considered to be our father, because they control the material energy. But you have to understand, the mother that we have is not the normal way you would think of a mother. She rides on a lion. Why does she ride on a lion? Right? She doesn't just ride on a horse. Right? She rides on a lion. Why? Because the lion represents victory. Right? I will subdue you. Right? You have no possibility of overcoming me. That's what Krishna says. Mama maya jarachyaya. No possibility of overcoming the material energy. Right? Unconquerable. Right? Because she rides on a lion. You can't conquer a lion. Right? Unless you're, you know, Bhima or someone like that. Bhima used to kill lions, right? But the rest of us, we have no hope like that. And she has 10 arms. And in those 10 arms, she has all different weapons. Right? And one of the weapons she has is a trident. It means a three-pronged spear. A spear with three heads like that. And with this spear, you see pictures of Durga, just like in, especially in Calcutta, in Bengal, they do Kali Puja. Durga Puja is very popular, like that. So you'll see she's always riding on the lion and she's killing one demon with the trident. Right? So the trident, the three prongs, represents the three modes of material nature. right? I will control you with goodness, with passion, and with ignorance. And if you look at us, we're basically just control. You see on that book, there's one of the books that came out from the BBT. Which one is it? Which has the puppet? The Laws of Nature, right? So you'll see on the front cover, right, the conditioned soul is just like a puppet, right? Just being carried by the three gunas. Like that. And that's what we're like. If you look at us the way we are practically all day, we're just like under the control of the three modes. Right? Here comes passion. Right? And then we get all passionate and we become all attached to something, or, you know, lust comes in our heart, or become attracted to a woman, or become attracted to a man, and like that. And the passion all rises up. And then ignorance comes sometime during the day. Right? And we just feel all sleepy. You know, you're sitting in Bhagavatam class and you just go... And then motor goodness comes up once in a while. You know, like that. So we're just completely under the control of the three modes of material nature, right? So she has a trident, she controls it. And the trident also represents past, present, and future, right? In other words, she controls us by time. Everyone's under the control of time. Try to defy time, right? Try to defy it. Try to stop time, right? It's impossible, right? And everyone spends their time thinking about what happened in the past, right? Or everyone spends their time thinking, oh, I will get this in the future, right? And half the time you never do, right? And then in the present, right? Sometimes we just become completely bewildered by something that's going on around us when we can get ourselves out of the past and the future. Sometimes we're just absorbed in some sense gratification in the present. So she controls us with this three-pronged spear. This is our mother in the material world. Yeah, therefore Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Jivjago, Gora Chandra Bole, Lord Chaitanya is saying, wake up sleeping souls. How long will you sleep in the lap of that witch called Maya? Right? You think you're in your mother's lap and you're comfortable, right? But she is a witch. No? She's our mother, but she's also a witch, right? Because she doesn't treat us very, you know, the mother usually treats you very gently. You know, when was the last time the material energy treated you gently? You know, probably in about 1974. You know, when was the last time you had like a nice, you know, gentle experience of the material energy? Generally, it doesn't happen. Also, the trident represents Adi Baltic, Adi Devic, and Adi Yatmic Klesha, which means miseries. Klesha means suffering or misery. Misery is given by your own mind and body, right? Imagine how nice life would be if you didn't have your mind. Right? Imagine if you just get rid of it for one day. You know, here's $20. Just go to the movies. Right? Right? Come back tonight. Right? Just give me a break. Yeah? Just give me 12 hours of peace. Right? Imagine how much life would be different. Right? And then the body will give suffering in due course of time. If it's not now, it will. Right? Just stick around. Right? Just think, if you're not suffering in your body right now, just then calculate what your age is, right? And if you're only 21 and you're not suffering in your body now, then just add 50 to that. Right? That's 71, and just wait. Right? And then you'll suffer, right? That's the material energy. Right? And then Adi Devic means by the demigods, right? The demigods will give us big problems if we don't cooperate with them. Krishna says in the third chapter of the Gita, when there is cooperation between men and demigods through sacrifice, the world becomes peaceful. You read in the Bhagavatam 5,000 years ago when there was jagya being performed on a daily basis, it was very peaceful on earth. It doesn't have to be the way it is now. We don't have to have drought. We don't have to have global warming. We don't have to have, you know, tsunamis. We don't have to have hurricanes. We don't have to have fires in Los Angeles. We don't have to have all these things. Right? But there has to be cooperation. And then the third one is Adi. Which one? Baltic, yeah, which means other living entities. Right? Imagine if you get rid of all the other living entities that give you problems. Right? Which means you'd have to get rid of half of the population of Earth. Right? Because everyone practically, every second person you meet becomes a problem in your life, practically. Right? And then you have special creatures which are just designed only to give you problems. Right? What's an example of a creature whose sole purpose of existence is to give you problems?
Mosquito.
Right? You take rest, right? And you just turn off the light and you're just about to start falling off to sleep, and then you hear Right, somewhere. Right? And what are they attracted to? Blood, yeah. But they're attracted to heat. And what's the hottest part of the body? The ear. The ear is the hottest part of the body. It's what's usually red. Right? It's the hottest part of the body. Isn't it funny? Right? Wherever, it doesn't matter where you are, what you're doing, how dark the room is. Right? So they can't see you. Right? You think, okay, I'll hide. But they always find your ear. Right? The only purpose of their existence is to annoy the hell out of you. Right? Especially the ones in India. They're really good, you know. Especially when you get in a room with about 25 in there. Right? And then they just all start coming to your ear. Zing, zing. Right? So, right? They start getting their formations and their patterns all set up and they'll start coming like that. So this is the material world. So then it's funny because on Sunday my wife and I, we took Prabhu Vishnu Swami shopping, and when we were leaving one of the shops, one of the guys, he said, enjoy. To us, as we like to say, enjoy. Yeah, that's like the motto. So we walking down the street, and Mara said, this is one of the mottos, enjoy. Like that. So how much illusion do you have to be in? You know, that's your motto, enjoy. I thought, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll enjoy. I'll enjoy the three modes of nature. I'll enjoy past, present, and future. I'll enjoy Adi David, Adi Baltic. Yeah, I'll enjoy, no problem. And how are you doing? You know, it's illusion. Like that. So therefore, that is the nature of the material world. So, Jarasandha, he is this kind of personality where he is rebellious of Krishna. He does not accept Krishna's supremacy. So we can follow that path, but if we do follow that path, then we will suffer immensely, because the material world is designed for suffering, and that suffering is God's mercy on us. It's punitive. It means Krishna is treating us harshly in order to rectify our consciousness, right? To make us come back to Godhead, right? It's an impetus, because to be honest, most of us would not be Krishna conscious unless we were suffering. Yeah, I wouldn't have joined the Hare Krishna movement if I wasn't suffering. Yeah, if I had got my material life together before I joined, I wouldn't have joined. You know, I would have just thought, oh yeah, it's nice, and you know, the books are far out and the food's wonderful and all, but I wouldn't have joined. But Krishna just, you know, annihilated my, you know, material life. You know, when Krishna is like, when you're playing chess with Krishna, it's like you go there and then Krishna goes there and then you go there and you go there and you know, you're trying to get out of surrendering. Yeah, and then he goes, checkmate. You know, what the hell? Right? He's taken away everything. I've got nothing left. I've got nothing left. Okay, surrender. Okay. Join. Like that. But it has to be deep. The point is, the surrender has to be deep. Because if the surrender is not deep, you will not stay. Because right? You see, since ISKCON started, ISKCON's been going for about 40 years now, then where are all the devotees? Yeah, a lot of devotees have left. Hundreds of thousands of devotees have left. So the surrender has to be deep to Krishna. Right? And I remember Tamal Krishna Maharaj was giving a lecture a long time ago, and he said one of the reasons why devotees leave is because they don't develop a relationship with Krishna. You have to develop a relationship with Krishna. You have to get to know him, and you have to get to love him. Like that. How do you get to know him? Right, you have to read the Krishna book. Right? That's why Prabhupada gave us the Krishna book in 1970. Right? Hands up if you've read the Krishna book. Oh, good. Good. Like that. So Prabhupada wanted this. Why? You know? The program in ISKCON, in the early days, in the 70s, when the movement was young, was that at night time, just before everyone took rest, everyone would drink hot milk and read Krishna book. That was the ISKCON program. Because Prabhupada said that if you read Krishna book before you take rest, you will dream of Krishna. Right? You'll become attached to Krishna, and you have to become attached to Krishna, because just becoming detached from the material energy will not take you back to Godhead. You know, just to think, okay, this material world is full of suffering, that's not enough to keep you here as a devotee, decade after decade after decade. Right? You won't stay a devotee just because, oh, the material world is suffering, I don't want to go back. You only stay a devotee. That is the impetus to begin devotional service, and that keeps us in devotional service over time. But the actual impetus to become fully Krishna conscious is to develop attachment to Krishna. And that's what Krishna says in the first verse of the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Right? The first verse of the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita was the verse that Prabhupada spoke on more than any other verse in the Bhagavad Gita. If you look at the lectures, Prabhupada speaking on Bhagavad Gita, when you get to chapter 7, verse 1, then Prabhupada has many lectures. I can't remember how many, but more than any of the others. And then chapter 9, verse 1 was the second most, like that. So Prabhupada spoke on it again and again and again. And what does the seventh verse, the first verse in the seventh chapter say? You have to develop asakti. Asakti means attachment to Krishna. Right? Krishna says you have to become attached to me. Because if you don't become attached to him, you'll become attached to everything in this material world. Right? And that's just going to lead you to coming back into this material world. But Krishna says, if you become attached to me, then when you leave this world, you'll come to me. That's what the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is about. The 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is about how to die. Right? That's what the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita teaches us, how to die. Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam. Right? Whatever you remember at the time of death, you will attain that without fail, Krishna says. Whatever your bhav is, right? Whatever you're absorbed in, whatever your consciousness gets absorbed in, that's what you'll remember at the time of death. And whatever you remember at the time of death, that takes you to your next birth. So if you get absorbed and attached to Krishna, then at the time of death, then being attached to him, Krishna said, you will come to me. And then that's the whole mission of human life accomplished. Otherwise, you didn't accomplish the mission. Just like there was that, what's that show that used to be on? Mission Impossible. Right, Mission Impossible. David Marita Swami wrote a Vyasa Puja homage to Prabhupada, or I think it was the introduction to the Vyasa, or the meaning of Vyasa Puja. It was about 5 years ago or something he wrote. And in that, he wrote the first line of his of the meaning of Vyasa Puja, or his homage that he wrote in that particular year. His first line was, "Welcome to Mission Impossible." Dun 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 dun. This is Mission Impossible. So what's Mission Impossible? Mission Impossible is to go back to Godhead. Right? You think it's easy to go back to Godhead? No, it's not. But if you don't pass the mission, you don't go back. Right? It's not like it's not going to be a challenge. Right? And you have to understand that every time there is a challenge, right, every time there is a difficulty on our path to go back to Godhead, you know who's causing that difficulty? Have a wild guess. Yeah. Who might be causing the difficulties that we're going through? You know, sometimes I think, oh, devotional service is so difficult. Who's causing the difficulties? Right? He's standing there and he's holding a flute and he's got a smile on his face. Right? He stands there with a smile, right? Causing all of your difficulties and all your suffering. And why does he do that? For one reason, because he wants to bring you back to Godhead. He's trying to detach you from the material world. So if you learn to see, and this takes a lot of practice and a lot of advancement in Krishna consciousness, but if you learn to see this test is coming from Krishna, right, and this Krishna wants me to pass this test and surrender to him, then you start going back to Godhead. But if you fail the test again and again and again, then you don't make progress. You stay in this material world and you keep suffering like that. So the choice is ours, which way we want to go. So Jarasandha, normally he doesn't speak anything worth hearing, but at the moment he's given Shishupal some good advice. He says to Shishupal, "I'm an experienced man, right? Because I attacked Mathura 17 times, and I got smashed. You know, I mean, you have to be pretty dull. It's like, you know, it's like stepping in the ring with Muhammad Ali, right? And you're in there, come on, champ, let's see, come on, yeah. right? And you're flat and KO'd, right? 5 seconds after you go in the ring, Ali just goes whack, and then you're like, KO'd." Right? So then it takes you 6 months to recover. You go back into training, because Jarasandha came back every year. You know, it takes you 6 months to get over the injury, you know, like to have your face reconstructed. And then after 6 months, right, then you go back into training. And then you come back, come on, champ, what do you got? Right? And then next year, come on, like that. like that, 17 times. Like, and Jarasandha's friends, his demoniac counsellors, kept saying to him, you just had a bad day. You know, it's just the Jyotish was, you know, off. You know, Saturn was in Aries, and you know, like, you know, you're just having a bad day. That's all. You'll get it back together. You know, you're Jarasandha, and that's the pride of the conditioned soul. You know, you're great. You'll get it back together. You know, you'll do it like that. And then we get all that egotistical. It doesn't matter how many times we've been smashed, but we get all egotistical. Yeah, I'm the man. I can do it. Yeah, I can do it. I'll be back. I'm coming. I'm making a comeback. Right? How many times do we have to be smashed? Right? So it says here in the Bhagavad Gita that Jarasandha got some realization. Because now Shishupal's getting the same treatment as what Jarasandha got. Right? Rukmini was just about to get married to Krishna. It was the day before the wedding, and she'd gone to the Durga temple, and all the chatris came to see her, right? Because her beauty was famous, right? And normally the women, because the women have to be chaste, right? And the women were normally kept in the palace. They weren't like out in public, so all the men could look at them. This is a princess. She doesn't just go out in the public, right? She's in the palace. She's not seen generally. You know, she occasionally. So her beauty was famous. So all the chakris came out just to see Rukmini. You know, how beautiful is she? So they're all waiting there, and Shishupal was waiting there, and Krishna drove in on the chariot, right? And took her by the hand and put her on the chariot and just looked at all of them, or maybe didn't even look at all of them, and he just rode off. And everyone's like, what was that all about? Yeah. What was that? Right? So then, and they're half expecting it. Right? They're half expecting it. It says earlier in the chapter they were expecting it. In the previous chapter it says they knew there's a good chance Krishna was going to do exactly that. So they were ready, right? So they just put on their armour, right? Picked up the bows, got the weapons. They were angry, right? And then they drove out. And they started following Krishna. Krishna's just going off, you know, with Rukmini. And then he looks back and there's like, you know, thousands of chariots like coming after him, you know? So then Krishna says to Rukmini, he says, can you take the reins? Right? And Rukmini says, yeah, I'll take the reins. So she takes the reins, and Krishna just takes out his bow, Shanga. Right? Krishna is known as Shanga Danda. Right? So he takes out his bow, and he just annihilates the warriors. Right? Smashes their chariots, smashes them with his arrows. The chariots smash apart under the force of his arrow. Smashes their armour. Even when they're about to shoot at him with an arrow, he cuts their bow string. That's how perfect he is. Like Krishna's like that. They're just about to shoot at Krishna, and then suddenly the bow string is gone. And then smash their bow and smashes it to smash everything. You know, not just one, but thousands of them. Right? Just smash them to pieces. Right? Because he wants to teach the conditioned soul, don't interfere with my marriage. You know, don't interfere with my pastimes. Right? I am the supreme enjoyer. Right? This is my goddess of fortune. It's not your goddess of fortune. Right? It's my goddess of fortune. Right? I am Bhagavan. I am Ishwara. This is my Lakshmi, my Mahalakshmi, my Rukmini. Right? Don't you dare try to touch her. Right? I will smash your consciousness. You should be a submissive servant of us. That is your position. And if that is not your position, if you will not accept your position, then I will smash you. So Shishupal got the same treatment as Jarasandha got, but then now Jarasandha's preaching to him. He's saying that's the nature of the material world. Sometimes things go good, sometimes things go bad. You have to be equipoised and just keep going back and fighting Krishna. Okay. So you miss the entire point. You know, if you keep going back for more, even after you get smashed, you're missing the point. Right? This is called third class intelligence. Third class intelligence is I learnt once, I learnt twice. I've learned 24 times, but still I'll go back and get smashed. Right, that's third class. Second class is, okay, you make the mistake once, and then, okay, now I've made the mistake, I won't do it again. First class is that you hear the material world is a place of suffering, and then, okay, then you don't have anything to do with it. There's very few people in this world who are first class like that. There are some devotees, you'll see, are first class. They don't make that mistake like that, but not many like that. Okay, so we'll stop here. I want to see if there's any questions or comments on what we discussed.
remember from the past time, actually, Valor also stepped in behind. He came with us, because he came in the Adam Warriors. He stepped in. Krishna's right on. Valor stepped in behind us.
Yeah, it comes up in the next few verses. You just go and relax and enjoy yourself. This is your marriage. Like that, so you just go and John will take care of the others. Then Balaram and the Yadu don't. The Vrishnis, they obliterated Shishupal. They obliterated them. Like that dynasty was so powerful, right? The commander in chief of the army was Satyaki. Right? I mean, he taught Krishna how to fight. He was Krishna's Danur Veda guru. He taught him the art of military science. Satyaki taught Krishna. So Satyaki was powerful. And then you have Prajumna, Andiruddha, Samba. I mean, these were powerful warriors. I think so. Any other points?
Could you tell us what is Rakshasa type of marriage?
Rakshasa means there are seven types of marriage. I can't remember all of them, but there are seven types of marriage. And three or four, Bhaktivedanta Pandit Maharaj, I heard him describing all these things. First three or four are considered to be high class, the proper way to get married. But then you have some that are considered not good ways to get married. Now the Rakshasa marriage, this style of kidnapping the bride, it's only auspicious for the Kshatriyas. It's not auspicious for a Brahmana to do it. If a Brahmana just walks in and just takes, you know, the girl and walk, it's not auspicious. It's considered to be not low class. And if the Vaishya Shudra did it, it's also not. But for the Kshatriya, it's considered auspicious. The Kshatriya can do it like that because it shows his prowess. So it's an auspicious way to get married like that. So Rakshasa marriage means kidnapping. He just goes and he just takes her, that's it.
By force.
Sometimes by force, or maybe he may sneak into the palace, just like Arjuna took Subhadra. Arjuna dressed up as a sannyasi.
Yeah.
Right. And Krishna said to him, he said, "You're a very strange looking sannyasi. Yeah, especially because you keep looking at my sister during dinner." He said, "You're a very strange sannyasi." Yeah. So then Arjuna said, anyway, just like that. So then Krishna said, "Kidnap her." Like that. If that's your desire, then you take her, kidnap her. So then he kidnapped her, he took her, and he drove out of Dwarka, and Balaram was infuriated, because Balaram was going to marry her to Duryodhana. Right? And he was infuriated, he was going to kill Arjuna. And Balaram said, "I'll kill him." So Balaram was about to go out and smash Arjuna, you know. And then Krishna fell at Balaram's feet, and Krishna said to Balaram, "You know, this is my desire, so please accept it." He said, "Okay, if it's your desire, then I'll accept it." Another type of marriage is Gandhava. Gandhava means the boy and the girl meet in an isolated place, like in a forest, where there's no one around and there's no permission from the parents. No permission. And they just take a vow of marriage, Gandhava. This is how the Gandhavas get married. Gandhavas are in the heavenly planets. They're just walking around the heavenly planets in the gardens. They meet some girl and they say, "Yes, let's have a union," and they just unite like that. So the Gandhava marriage means that the boy and girl may meet somewhere in the forest and they exchange garlands and they just say, "Okay, I'm your wife, I'm your husband," and they get married. So I think the Kshatriyas can also do that, but it's not considered to be normally auspicious. In most of the social orders in society, if someone does that, then it's considered to be not nice. It's not proper. But I think the Kshatriyas can do their Gandhava marriage and it's okay. I think...
Tulsi.
Tulsi what?
She
knows. Oh, that's how Tulsi got married. Okay. And I think also Maharaj Shantu. Mm-hmm. I think he also did the Gandhava. Shantanu.
Gangadevi.
That's how they got married. I think it was a Gandhava marriage. They just met and then they just accepted each other. But that's okay for the Kshatriya. But you know, if we walk around just starting to, you know, "Oh, you look nice, you know, we'll get married like that." It's not proper. Okay. Or if you kidnap one of the girls. Okay. Yeah, throw in your Commodore and drive down the back. then you'll have a few of us chasing you. Like that. With the spoons from the pot shop. It will give you good beating. Someone else had a question. So the three modes are shaktis or energies. So they're under the control of Durga. Just like the Brahma Samhita, it says that the trident, which he carries, is the three modes. So in other words, it's Durga Devi who controls the three modes.
Yeah.
They're like shaktis or energies, which he controls. Her and Lord Shiva, they control. And they keep everyone controlled by those.
It's meant the personifications of them, because they're like three layers painted. So it's never seen anything else about those personalities?
I've never heard of personalities of the three modes. I've never heard.
Yeah.
I've never
seen this picture.
Yeah, the picture is there. But the picture is showing us that we are under the control of the three modes like that.
Yeah.
And I've never heard that there are three personalities
that
represent the modes. There could be.
Yeah.
But I've never heard there are. The Durga is in control of the modes.
Yeah. And the other question I have, but sometimes you see Durga riding on a lion, she said that also she sometimes rides on a tiger.
Same thing. So, tiger and lion are as strong as each other, probably. So, in Brahma Samhita, she's on a lion. That's what it says in Brahma Samhita.
Mm-hmm.
But then sometimes you see it's written, because in Bengal, which is where she's very popular, they have tigers, they don't have lions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can say like the same thing.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lion. It's written in the Shastra that she rides on a lion.
Yeah.
But a tiger, same thing. I mean, she's on a very potent animal.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be like that. Any other question or comment?
You said that sometimes Krishna pays difficulties. So, especially Maya is like, we sometimes pay difficulties in Krishna consciousness. So, Maya is only for materialists. So, is it we also pay some difficulties for Maya? Or is it only Krishna? You know, and is it like Krishna wants us to surrender more, that's why he's creating a difficult situation? Or is it Maya as well? And how to distinguish whether it's Krishna or it's Maya?
No, for a devotee, it's always Krishna. But the point is that Maya is Krishna's energy. Maya is Krishna's maidservant. So the tests we get come from Maya. But it's under Krishna's direction. In other words, she's working under Krishna's control, Krishna's will. Like that. Whereas for a non-devotee, it is just, she is just responding to their reactions, to their past sinful or pious activities. But for a devotee, it's not just karma. Krishna is involved, so she's fulfilling Krishna's desire. Because she's a pure devotee. So pure devotees always act on to fulfill Krishna's desire. So that's her duty or service. I think so. Does that make sense? Is that okay?
Just one last question. It's like we do this for everyone else, wanting to enjoy material physical and capable and spiritual. Is there any possibility that even when we go back, can we have the same mentality again?
Yeah, Prabhupada said once, because they asked Prabhupada this question, and then Prabhupada said, once burnt, twice shy. Mm-hmm. So what will happen is that you may go back to the spiritual world, and if you ever think of misusing your independence again, then Krishna will allow you to remember your millions of lifetimes that you went through last time, and then you'll say, well, yeah, maybe I'll... Okay, I won't go. Any other questions or comments?